From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Investigators believe that explosion in downtown Nashville on Christmas Day was a suicide bombing, and they've identified the person they believe is responsible, Anthony Quinn Warner. Warner died in the explosion, which also injured three people and damaged dozens of historic buildings. Joining us now with the latest developments is Nina Cardona from our member station WPLN in Nashville. Nina, welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Authorities are still piecing together a motive for this attack, but what can you tell us about Anthony Q. Warner?
Well, Anthony Warner was a Nashville native. He lived in the same house for three decades in the same part of town where he'd grown up. People who knew him as a kid describe him as being quiet and kind of nerdy. He did have a charge of felony drug possession on his record. He was caught with marijuana, apparently with the intent to sell it, but that was in 1978, and he hadn't had any other run-ins with police since. He worked in IT. He did computer repair on a contract basis. And it sounds so cliche after something like this, but neighbors say he kept to himself. He didn't give any indication of his politics or his religion. They did notice about a month ago that he moved his RV from the driveway into a fenced-in area in his yard. And that's about the same time that records show he signed away ownership of his house and he canceled a contract with a regular client with no explanation shortly after that point.
So many questions here, but do investigators think anyone else is involved?
No, at this point, it looks like they're working on the theory that he was working alone. Now, there was a scare yesterday in a neighboring county when a box truck began playing a recording similar to what was heard from coming from the RV before the explosion, but that just turned out to be a copycat hoax.
Oh, wow. What criteria does an intentional bombing like this need to meet to be considered an act of domestic terrorism?
Authorities say they need a certain kind of motive. Basically, they only use the word terrorism if they know that some kind of ideology was at play. From a reporter's point of view, it sure looks like they're investigating this as potential terrorism. The way they won't say what kind of warrant was used to search Warner's house, the kind of personnel that they brought in to work the case. But they're not saying that at this point. Because the motive or what kind of beliefs even that Warner had about the world are still just open questions in need of answers. He didn't seem to be someone who ranted about what was bothering him. There's no sign at this point of a manifesto published online anywhere. In fact, he doesn't seem to have been on social media at all. Detectives were seen taking quite a bit of material out of his home on Saturday. So we assume they're pouring through all of that to see what they can find about his state of mind. And several people who've been questioned by the FBI about Warner have told reporters afterwards that they were asked things like whether or not Warner bought into 5G conspiracy theories. But at this point, officials. Right. That's the line of questioning. And people are saying, oh, we didn't know anything about what he thought. So we don't know what kind of answers they're getting that are helpful. At this point, when officials have been asked about those questions, they say they're asking all kinds of questions in hopes of just finding something that lands and gives some kind of clue about his motivations. And, you know, there are also these weird details that confuse things. The way that he used a recording from the RV to warn everybody away, seemingly to avoid hurting people. And the fact, this is so strange, that he used the RV's loudspeakers to play the song Downtown by Petula Clark before he started the countdown to the explosion. I mean, there's just so much to sort through and make sense of.
Yeah, that line of questioning about 5G, you said. Warner parked his RV outside of an AT&T building. It's a regional transmission hub, and the explosion knocked out internet and cell service, as well as disrupted 911 calls. How are efforts going to restore service? And I'm sure that is probably something that a line of questioning that investigators are also thinking about, the connection between AT&T and
absolutely. And that's certainly the question that is on everybody's mind in the public and among the reporting corps as well. As of this morning, AT&T says that almost all service is restored. That's, though, through a patchwork of temporary measures. It seems that the equipment in that structure may be in okay condition, but getting power to it safely is another matter. I have some of it up and running again, but the building itself has several gaping holes on the exterior, and just like so many others up and down the street, it caught on fire. It was partially flooded. And so much of we've discovered connection points for the entire Southeast was housed in that building.
On Friday, you told us that people felt this explosion from miles around. A section of downtown has been heavily damaged. How are people in Nashville dealing with this?
You know, in some ways, I'm not sure the destruction of it really feels completely real yet for everyone. That's going to take some time to really hit fully. the AT&T outage complicates matters. It got in the way of people being able to connect and commiserate, but it also gave people a thing to focus on and complain about. But I think as a city, we're all just so incredibly thankful that of all times, this happened when that area was all but empty. So no one was killed except for the bomber. Nobody was seriously injured. People are expressing a great deal of respect for the police on the scene who acted so fast and evacuated the area before the RV exploded. And there's a lot of concern for the service industry workers. There's so many people out of a job now because they worked at a restaurant or a bar or a souvenir shop that is in ruins. So there are a lot of efforts underway to raise money to help those people pay their bills.
Nina Cardona from WPLN in Nashville, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
Well, we're heading into the second month of what CDC Director Robert Redfield said was going to be the most difficult time in the public health history of America, largely because of the stress on the healthcare system. Already, the Los Angeles County Communicable Disease Chief told residents, don't come to the ER or call 911 unless it's a true emergency. Hospitals are filling. Let's get some COVID-19 questions answered by Dr. Lena Wen with us on Skype. She's emergency physician and professor of public health at George Washington University. Doctor, people are being told to go to urgent care clinics. Do you fear we're going to see more of that?
Unfortunately, yes, because we are seeing the statistics that one in five hospitals in the U.S. are reporting that their ICUs are full or nearly full. And we know that when that happens, it's not just care for coronavirus patients that's compromised. It's care for all patients, patients with heart attacks, patients who are coming in for car accidents. They're not able to get the ideal medical care that they really need.
Okay, well, here's a question that's been asked of me by friends. The Wall Street Journal had a disturbing report that doses of unused monoclonal antibodies by Regeneron, these were authorized for emergency use last month, are sitting stockpiled in hospital shelves, even though they've been shown to be effective in preventing severe illness in mild and moderate cases of COVID-19. Now, according to the journal, some infectious disease specialists said they wanted more trials. That got some people scared. But also, primary care doctors who write prescriptions, they don't know about this. There's also speculation that people think it's only for the well-known or the wealthy, so they don't ask for it. And Dr. Emily Rubin from Mass General Hospital in Boston told the Wall Street Journal, some patients are declining it. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this monoclonal antibody is the one that was given to President Trump, to a number of other people. In addition, it has been given, as you said, emergency use authorization. And the idea is that patients have to be, they have to have mild symptoms. And this needs to be early on in the course of their illness to be given this treatment. And that ideally prevents them from proceeding then to moderate or severe illness. That sounds good, except that this is difficult to administer. It's not a pill that someone can take. You actually have to go into a hospital setting in order to receive an IV infusion. And many patients, by the time that they seek medical care, they're beyond that initial window of time for them to receive this therapy. It's also in very limited supply. And so in different parts of the country, there are lots of different criteria that you have to meet. For example, you have to be older with chronic medical illnesses. And so I think there's a lot that we need to figure out because there are places where there is a lot of need and patients are not receiving it, and other places where, as you said, it appears that they are sitting on shelves. So I think much better national coordination is needed.
Oh, sure. I want to talk about the new variant of the coronavirus. We know it's far more infectious. It spreads faster. It is not more deadly than the current one, but it has spread to half a dozen countries. What we don't know is whether it's in the U.S. because, you know, we're at the bottom of the barrel of testing for variants. Why is that?
I think testing has been our Achilles heel during this entire pandemic. The fact that we've only done genomic surveillance for about 0.5%, less than 0.5% of all the cases is a major problem. And this variant in the UK has been known since the end of September. So given the amount of travel back and forth and also how much coronavirus is spread in our country, I'd be very surprised if it's not already here. And while there is good news that this variant appears not to be more deadly, as you said, by definition, if it's more transmissible, if it causes more infections, then there will also be more cases of severe illness and more deaths. So I'm very concerned about this variant, but not just about the concept that there is this new variant. It's that there are other variants that could appear in the future if we don't get this pandemic under control.
Yeah, and we don't want to give the impression that people may not die of it. They will. And when more people get it, as you said, there will be more deaths. Look, just briefly, what about people with allergies? We're hearing you know, anecdotally, that there are different cases where people have had the vaccine and have had an allergic reaction. Should people who have allergies take the vaccine?
Yes, they should, unless they have an allergy to a specific component of that vaccine. But other people who have food allergies or medication allergies should get the vaccine. They if they get the vaccine, they'll be in a monitored setting, and we know how to treat allergic reactions. It's much easier to treat allergic reactions than to treat the complications of coronavirus. But I would definitely urge for more studies to be done on people with severe allergies, because we need to better reassure the American people and also to identify exactly why these allergies happen.
Yeah. Dr. Lena Wen, emergency doctor, professor of public health at George Washington University. Doctor, thank you, as always, for coming in with your expertise.
Thank you, Robin.
This year, we turned Zoom into a verb, Airbnb into a refuge, and watched as lawmakers in congressional hearings accused big tech of illegally squashing the competition. What a year it's been for some of the world's biggest tech companies. And now we're going to take a look back with two tech editors and reporters. Ina Fried is a chief technology correspondent for Axios, and Ronnie Mola is senior data reporter for Recode. Hello and welcome to both of you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, in the midst of so much this year, we watched federal scrutiny of some of the tech giants heat up, Facebook, Twitter, Apple, and Google. And now at least two of those companies, Google and Facebook, are the subjects of lawsuits from federal regulators and state attorneys general. Ina, I'll start with you. How big of a shift was there in Washington this year over tech regulations?
Well, I think you mentioned that the suits themselves are the action. I think the theater of having the executives hauling them before Congress was more an act of frustration and good political theater. The real action is that they went to court against two of these companies. And we haven't seen that really since the Microsoft trial, you know, 2 decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Ronnie, do you think we're going to see significant changes as a result of Washington's renewed interest in antitrust?
I mean, I should hope so, just by the sheer number of cases that are being filed so far against, you know, there's three against Google, one against Facebook. There's probably going to be ones against Apple and Amazon. Alternatively, Congress could certainly pass legislation that could govern these tech companies a little bit more than we've been doing.
Sure, because there have been a lot of hearings, but it seems like Democrats and Republicans are talking past each other.
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact that we did see bipartisan lawsuits is a sign that there is some common ground. I think a lot of what we saw on Capitol Hill was actually different frustrations. You had Democrats talking about one thing, you had Republicans talking about anti-conservative bias. So there was shared frustration, but not about the same thing. So I think the chance of legislation is probably smaller. In the lawsuits, they were actually able to find enough common ground, which is something, and something in 2020 where there wasn't a lot of bipartisan consensus on anything.
You know, something else that we saw this year, big tech seemed to get even bigger, even as the rest of the economy really flailed. Ina, were you surprised that big tech had a banner year by some measures in the middle of what is a really tough time?
Not really. I mean, it is remarkable how many things we were able to keep going in some form thanks to tech. So for those who could work at home, who could safely stay home, you could listen to concerts over the internet, you could do a lot of the things you'd want to do. It wasn't the same. But mm-hmm. tech is really what enabled it to be somewhat bearable for some portion of the population. Again, I don't want to make it seem like this was equally accessible, because it wasn't. But just imagine how much worse this year would have been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, before we had video games, Minecraft, Roblox, Peloton, all the things that enabled some semblance of normalcy, or at least an alternative to the way we used to do things.
Mm-hmm. You know, among all of the tech that helped us through this year, Airbnb seemed to do really well. It was a company that had its ups and downs, but the short-term rental company saw their business model upended during the pandemic, but then it rebounded by the end of the year with a huge IPO. I mean, Ronnie, what does this story tell you about Airbnb in the Silicon Valley?
Well, I think it points to a fundamental thing about software companies and a lot of tech companies these days, and that a lot of these companies don't actually own the thing that they're selling. You know, Airbnb is the software that rents out people's rooms or homes. And, you know, so they didn't have to suffer necessarily as bad. And then there's part of the story has to do with just like one of those flukes of the pandemic, in that they're able to sort of pivot their site to gear it more towards, hey, you know, if I live in New York City, where is a place upstate New York that I could, you know, get out of my tiny apartment for?
Mm-hmm. We also saw this rise of Zoom when so many of us, our lives are now shifted where we're doing remote work. And Amazon saw this explosive growth as the trend towards online shopping accelerated. There's actually one statistic here. In the third quarter, Amazon raked in about a record $6.3 billion in profit, triple what it made a year before. And we also saw huge growth in streaming services. Do you think those trends will continue after this pandemic is over, Ronnie?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. You saw the move to e-commerce has been, you know, it's been a decade long. This was just sort of one of those final pushes. You know, it was harder to convince people to, say, get their groceries online. But during the pandemic, that became a necessity for a lot of people. I think once a large portion of the population has had exposure to buying things online, it's kind of hard to go back from there.
I would agree. I would just say that a little bit of a contrarian take on e-commerce is that really the traditional commerce companies, all the people that operate bricks and mortar, whether it's big companies or small business, had been sort of slowly suffocating, slowly seeing their business run off to Amazon and other e-commerce companies. The pandemic actually forced them, because it took away all their business temporarily, not just what was slowly shifting to Amazon, but everything, forced them to learn things like curbside delivery, taking orders online and fulfilling them locally. Those are actually skills that will benefit them. So I still expect Amazon to keep chipping away and taking more market share. But I do think there is perhaps a silver lining for retailers that they had to learn how to do some of their business online this year. And those skills may well serve them in the years to come.
Ronnie, you've also been following the continuing saga of WeWork. You actually recently wrote that the pandemic could have crushed WeWork, but it may have actually saved it instead. Please tell us how so.
This is another one of those just contrary stories that came out of the pandemic, you know, a company that actually did well. And so WeWork, to be clear, isn't doing super well. They're just losing less money than they used to. And all the real estate experts I've been speaking with think that this sort of space is going to be doing really well when the pandemic is over. And part of that is because companies that rent office space don't really know where their workforce is going to be. So many of us, especially if you have an office job, are working remotely. We might have moved. There's going to be a more dispersed workforce. So when your company doesn't know quite where your workforce is going to be, they don't really want to have these long-term leases, you know, 10, 15-year leases on an office space. That's why things like WeWork and its competitors who offer, you know, month-to-month contracts for space might do really well when this is all over.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask you about something else that really made the news this year. And it was tech companies really taking a stand, specifically social media companies starting to crack down on misinformation and conspiracy theories. We saw this in the way of Twitter flags, some of its content now that it says could be misinformation. Was this year a turning point on this issue?
I'm going to say not yet. I'm going to say this was the year that the tech companies started to take it more seriously, but I don't think we've hit the turning point. I still feel like misinformation is spreading faster. You know, don't forget that the tech companies are labeling things, but often by the time they label them, they've already spread very widely. And also, we've seen research that shows that just labeling content tends to reinforce people's already perceived impressions. So if they see the tech companies as liberally biased, a warning flag actually sort of feeds into that. So I still think there need to be more effective methods. We're losing the battle. We're having debates every day about things that should be just accepted facts. And I don't feel good about where we're at as a society.
Well, there are so many other stories that could take shape as important turning points in 2021. The SolarWinds hack, Tesla's dealings, the rollout of 5G, the explosion of TikTok and the Trump administration threatening to ban it. I want to ask both of you, is there a tech story you think deserves more attention in 2021, maybe something that got overshadowed by everything else happening this year. I'll start with you, Ina.
I think we're still, especially on the Congress and regulatory front, fighting the battles we can see, which obviously makes sense. You fight the battles you can see. But I think the invisible battle against algorithms that have bias is going to be increasingly more important. So I think the idea that decisions are being made by a set of characteristics that we don't really understand, whether that's getting a loan, getting a job, getting a house, all these things. And I think that's going to be a big issue for 2021 and the years to come.
Ronnie.
Yeah, one thing that was sort of highlighted this year was our access to broadband. You know, it became so important that if we wanted to do anything, social life or work, we had to have fast internet. And I think because of the pandemic, the issue of inequality in broadband has really been highlighted.
Ronnie Mola is senior data reporter for Recode, and Ina Fried is chief technology correspondent for Axios. Thank you both for this discussion and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And to Mexico now, and the city of Hermosillo, the capital of the state of Sonora. It's struggling with a familiar problem, urban sprawl. Some residents, though, are turning to greening projects as they try to make the city a better place to live. Kendall Blust of member station KJZZ reports.
A few dozen volunteers gather on a rocky hillside on the northern end of Hermosillo. Picks and shovels in hand, they carve a winding trail through the desert.
El Cinturón Verde es un proyecto de movilidad urbana sustentable.
Sofia Vargas is a leader with Caminantes del Desierto, the group spearheading the Cinturón Verde, or Green Belt. She says the goal of the six-mile hiking and biking trail is to create a conservation zone, halting development and protecting wildlands beyond the existing city limits.
Entonces, ese es el objetivo realmente, que quede como una zona de conservación.
The project is part of a growing green movement in the city. Guadalupe Peñuñori, head of the city's Urban Planning Institute, says attitudes towards sustainability have changed dramatically in Hermosillo.
Es muy, muy evidente en la ciudad cómo se está cambiando.
It makes sense, she says, in a city where residents so starkly see and feel the effects of shrinking vegetation and rising temperatures.
Hermosillo, como muchas ciudades en México, presenta el problema de que crece.
For decades now, Hermosillo has grown outward, eating up land with poorly planned developments. That sprawl has led to reliance on cars, the loss of natural habitats and wildlife, and a languishing city center. Peñuñori says she's worked for years to build a foundation for sustainable development in the city, but there are limited resources.
Por eso estamos buscando estos como que proyectos pilotos.
That's why they're eager to support citizen-led efforts like the Green Belt. With the collective doing the labor, the city rezoned the area to prevent further development into the mountainside. Peñuñori calls it a pilot project that could pave the way for other similar efforts. The city has also turned to outside organizations and grants for help, recently receiving funds to reforest and create a park on the city's iconic Cerro La Campana Hill. Still, many conservation groups are frustrated with state and local leaders. Earlier this year, demonstrators blared car horns during a COVID-safe protest against the city's planned sale of El Cárcamo, a large outdoor complex with sports fields and a walking path. Thousands of neighbors, youth sports teams, and environmental groups put up intense opposition, eventually halting the sale.
Pues bueno, somos un grupo de ciudadanos preocupados por promover cambios en la ciudad, ¿no?
Joel Montoya belongs to a group working to turn El Cárcamo and the surrounding area into a huge park, starting with an area called La Sauceda. Hummingbirds flit through Palo Verde trees, and herons and ducks lounge in the shady shallows of the small oasis hemmed by roads and concrete.
¿Nunca te imaginas que encuentras este lugar aquí en Hermosillo?
Architect Blanca Olivia Cota says you'd never expect to see beautiful wetlands like this in Hermosillo. She's drawn up plans to extend the wetlands, create a botanical garden out of a long-abandoned theme park, and add hiking and biking paths in the neighboring hills. It's an ambitious project.
Es muy fácil. Parece que está muy complicado.
But Cota says it's easier than it seems. Much of the infrastructure is already in place, and there's tremendous support from the community. Joel Montoya says that's because these greening efforts aren't just about planting trees and protecting wildlife.
No solo es verde, es decir, no solo son árboles.
It's about making Hermosillo a better place to live, with shaded sidewalks, attractive parks, and community spaces filled with greenery. Things Montoya and others believe are not only possible, but necessary for the future livability of their city. For Here and Now, I'm Kendall Blust in Hermosillo.
As you know, the pandemic brought on the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And even with the promise of new vaccines, public health experts don't expect life to go back to normal anytime soon. So we must hunker down for the winter and focus on the light at the end of the tunnel to guide us into 2021. I'm referring, of course, to our personal finance expert, Jill Schlesinger. She's here to help us do some financial preparation. She's also CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome and happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much, and to you as well.
You know, you've talked about how the economy is undergoing a K-shaped recovery. So some people have seen their incomes actually grow during the pandemic. Millions more Americans out of work, on the longest food lines we've seen in modern memory. So just briefly, where are we in the recovery now?
You know, it is sort of the recovery went from we had end of February, March, April, really awful. The economy was shut down and everybody was simply frozen. And then we had after that a thawing, and there was a lot of activity. June, July, August, September, even October, there was a lot of recovery, and we have recouped more than half of the jobs lost. We lost 22 million jobs over the course of 2 months. About 12 million of those are back. Little less than 10 million are still missing. So what that tells you is that, yes, it has been a really strong recovery, but we're not there yet. And as this economy was making progress, we had a surge in the virus, and the economy is slowing down again.
And it was entirely predicted. You know, if people went out and traveled or gathered over Thanksgiving, we were told that there'd be a surge. And we're expecting another one after Christmas for the same reason. So start with tax season. Let's give people something to do. You know, how can you best prepare?
Economic stimulus checks, the $1,200 checks from the spring, the new $600 checks that are about to go out. Those are not taxable, but if you collected unemployment benefits, either through your state or through the CARES Act programs, those dollars are taxable. And if you didn't withhold because maybe you couldn't afford to, you're going to need to plan on paying the tax due on that in April. For everyone else, maybe you're lucky enough, you got your job, go to the IRS website, irs.gov. They've got a withholding estimator, and you want to see, have I withheld enough money to pay my tax bill in April? That, to me, is the most important thing you can do. It's proactive and it's easy.
Now, and by the way, the IRS extended the deadline earlier this year when the pandemic hit. Do you think they'll do that again?
I do not think so. And I think that that was a really strange situation. And I think that many people got very confused around that. But just plan on April 15th again. So that will be your milestone that you're looking for. I also want to remind a lot of folks, we had a tax law change in 2017. And that tax law changed the actual definition of what you could deduct and what you couldn't. If you're an employee, you can't deduct anything. You're done. No miscellaneous business expenses. You really have to be careful with that. Let's just say that you're Robin, who is a contractor doing radio work on the side, right? If that's the case, if you're a contractor, you're self-employed, you're a gig worker, you can deduct some portion of your housing expenses. Remember that to qualify as a deduction, you have to have exclusive use of some portion of your home for conducting business on a regular basis, and it's got to be your principal place of business. So if you're shacking up with your parents down on the Cape and you want to try to figure out how to deduct a room of theirs, not going to work.
Right, right. Or your closet. By the way, early on in the pandemic, there were all these stories about how people decamped immediately to wonderful islands, and then things started to go really lopsided sideways. I mean, some of them found that there were financial rules in the places where they were decamped to. If you are somewhere else and you're working, not just in your house or your parents' house, are there any deductions you should think about there?
You know, I spoke to my friends over at the American Institute of CPAs, and I asked them about this. You know, what are the rules? And it was really interesting because about 20% of people are teleworking because of the pandemic, and a lot of people outside of their normal place of residence. So AICPA recommends that you check out the number of days that you worked in any state or city, county, municipality, any other jurisdiction than your normal one. Just tally up those days for 2020. Then you're going to check with your primary residence rules about other jurisdictions, and you can make some adjustments to your withholding. Now, the good news is if you happen to have gone to a place that has a lower tax impact on you, you might have overwithheld. Okay, so you'll get a little tax refund come April. But it is worth going through this exercise because you may owe more, but you might be due some.
Yeah. You write in your blog, Jill on Money, that now's a good time to open a Roth IRA. That's the retirement account where you do pay taxes on the money that goes into the account, then paying after you retire when you take it out. Why are you recommending this now?
Well, I think a lot of people earned less money in the year 2020, and that may mean that you've dropped down in a tax bracket. So maybe you were in the 22% tax bracket, but now you're in the 12% tax bracket. So maybe you'd rather pay the 12% tax on your income right now, put the money into a Roth, and have it grow without any taxation, because down the line, it's unlikely you will remain in the 12% tax bracket. And also, I think that it's really worth saying here that individual tax rates are really at their lowest level in decades. So the old rule of thumb was put money away on a tax-deferred basis for retirement, because when you retire, you'll likely be in a lower tax bracket. I'm not sure that that is a rule of thumb anymore. We don't know. You could be in a higher tax bracket because maybe tax rates overall will be rising in the future.
Yeah, we saw over the past year, a lot of people took retirement, not of their own choice, years earlier than they thought they might because of the pandemic. So considerations there. 2020, crazy, crazy year for the stock market. Tech stocks booming with historic IPOs, Airbnb, DoorDash. And if you haven't invested in the stock market, is now a good time to get in?
I am a big fan of time in the market, not timing the market. If you had a freak out in March and you bailed out of everything you owned and went to cash, I understand that. So you can feel bad for yourself for about a second. Now get off your pity pot and let's get a plan of action to put your money back to work. And the easiest way to do this is to put it on autopilot. You say to yourself, all my money is sitting in cash right now. I am a long-term investor. I made a mistake. So I'm investing for 30 years in the future. I'm going to take 10% of the money and automatically have the money go into a diversified portfolio. And that way I'm going to stick with it. Okay? Now, I think that there's something really interesting here is that you don't have to know where the stock market's going next. What you have to know is where you are going next. If you have a lot of confidence in your ability to retain your job, if you've got an emergency reserve fund, if you've paid down your credit card debt and you're funding retirement accounts, then just keep at it.
No. Credit card debt, you mentioned if you've paid down your credit cards, what if you haven't? You know, we know so many people were relying on credit to pay bills. So how can people start paying off some of that debt?
When I was in the business of giving financial advice, I found that people who were able to actually pay down their debt became phenomenal savers, phenomenal. And here's why. Because we would walk them through this process and we'd say, okay, how much money are you spending? And now you are going to try to identify some amount of money, again, automatically that you can push towards your credit card debt or any outstanding, nefarious debt. And once you're done paying down that debt, really, you're turning a switch. It's like basically you're on a train track and you're sort of saying, okay, let me just switch it over to the right track. And that right track, instead of paying down debt, is going to go to saving.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, host of Jill on Money, with some ideas for how, you know, we can take control. I mean, that's really what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, the Jill on Money podcast used to be twice a week. And in March, we got inundated with emails and requests, and people were freaking out. And I said to my producer, I started laughing. I said, this is hysterical. As a certified financial planner, all the stuff that I say every single day, all year long, all these years, it just sort of comes back into vogue. It's like saying, you know, my mother says to me, really, you need a black suit. And you know, she's right. You need a black suit. So this is the black suit of your financial life. These are the things you need to be thinking about.
Yeah. Jill Schlesinger, thank you so much. And I just wish you the best of, you know, we all are trying to find hope and peace this holiday season. So I wish it to you. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
And if you missed anything, there was so much. Go to hereandnow.org.
It's that time of year again, the naming of the word of the year. And for the first time, the Oxford English Dictionary says there are too many words to choose from. So they chose several, including mail-in, unmute, lockdown, and coronavirus. Pandemic is the word of the year for the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And earlier this year, Merriam-Webster expanded its definition of the word racism after recent college graduate Kennedy Mitchum wrote in and asked for it. I spoke with Kennedy Mitchum back in June about why she felt an updated definition of racism was needed. So Merriam-Webster Dictionary has long served as the gatekeeper of the English lexicon. The current definition in the dictionary defines racism as, quote, a belief that race is the primary determinant of human rights and capabilities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. And you say that definition is inaccurate. Say more.
There's a lot of systemic elements to racism. And with everything going on, I think that everyone should be aware of that. It's not just disliking someone because of the color of their skin. There are systems in place in healthcare and the justice system that, you know, are automatically formed to put people of color at the bottom and keep them at the bottom of the barrel. So I thought that the dictionary definition should represent that, you know, to avoid misinforming the masses.
Mm-hmm. This all started when you shared a post on Facebook about how microaggression is a form of racism. I understand that you received responses from your friends. What were they saying to you?
Yes, they were basically just saying, like, do you understand the definition of racism? Because that's actually not racism. Someone, those words, they don't mean anything. They're just words. That's not okay. That it may not be as blatant as you want it to be. It may not be, you know, a note with the N-word, but it still hurts.
Yeah, what you're saying there is that that is a microaggression, which is a form of racism when someone is questioning your ability.
Right, exactly. And that's something that, especially being surrounded by a lot of white bodies in college, that's something that I've gotten really accustomed to. It's not the blatant form. It's a lot of people questioning me or just not acknowledging my presence just because I am an African-American woman. So that is racism in itself. So that's kind of something that I thought the dictionary should be able to understand as well.
So you felt that this definition wasn't telling the whole story. What happened next? How did you get the dictionary to revise this definition?
I just sent out a request through email, and I just stated my claims that it's really misinforming the masses if you guys don't mention the systematic elements of racism and the role that it plays in everyday life. So you guys should really mention that in the definition. And so they got back to me fairly quickly, which I really did like. An editor reached out, and we just had some conversations back and forth. And their main claim and their what was holding them back was just because they said that they focused on the majority and how they use the word in literature and different things. But I kept questioning that because the minority, they're the ones who, you know, experience this on a day-to-day basis. So why aren't you looking at minority literature, and why aren't you trying to understand different minorities and as they view the word, as they experience the word, as it's very active in their lives?
You sent them this letter. There was a back and forth. When did you send the letter, and how long did it take until there was a resolution?
So I sent the letter May 28th, and then I got a resolution June 4th.
Not everyone is happy with this change. What's been the reaction?
Yeah, a lot of people have been saying, like, you can't change the dictionary to fit your narrative. But I think that the problem is that it's not a narrative. This has been happening to people of color. We've not just experienced, you know, the overt racism for years now. We've been experiencing all different types. Those people really just aren't understanding the history behind this. Obviously, a lot of the people who are angry, they just want to be ignorant and they want to stay stagnant. I thought maybe the dictionary changing would, you know, give them a little kick in the butt to try to change and understand as well.
Kennedy, you studied law, politics, and society, and you have a minor in journalism and public relations from Drake University. What's your takeaway from this experience?
I think it's very important to keep trying for your voice to be heard, especially a lot of people in my generation. They just think, you know, okay, we see our parents who still may be struggling because of the way that the systems are often harder for us to break through, but don't let that discourage you. So I think that my whole takeaway is just to really use your voice, find your voice, use your skills in order to make a difference.
That's Kennedy Mitchum. She's a recent graduate of Drake University who asked Merriam-Webster Dictionary to update its definition of racism. And they said yes. Kennedy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Merriam-Webster Dictionary updated its definition of the word back in August to include the systemic elements of racism and how it plays out in everyday life. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.